This is Building Bridges, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
What we don't talk about when we talk about jobs, how racism, global economics, and the new Jim Crow fuel Black America's crippling jobs crisis.
The Labor Department released the latest figures on unemployment and payrolls. The unemployment rate rose to 9.2%, and employers added only 18,000 jobs last month, below the 150,000 threshold that economists say is needed to prevent the unemployment rate from increasing.
The figures were dismal for the working class. However, what isn't delineated and probed within that general dilemma is the unemployment rate for Black workers, almost double the percent rate for the rest of the population. It's twice the 8% white jobless rate. Since the 1940s, the jobless rate for Blacks in America has held grimly steady at twice the rate for whites. The question of why has divided economists, historians, and sociologists for nearly as long.
With us is Andy Kroll, associate editor of Tom Dispatch and reporter at Mother Jones Magazine, to discuss what we don't talk about when we talk about jobs, how racism, global economics, and the new Jim Crow fuel Black America's crippling jobs crisis.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for joining us. Critical issue. Help us understand more about that. This isn't just a cyclical reality or a current reality. There is a consistency, and maybe we can parse out some of the factors that you've looked at to try to understand the prevalence and persistence of African American unemployment.
I came at this looking for a job story that no one else had really written. I started just by going into that raw data that the Labor Department releases each month and looking for something that popped out. I went into the categories that break it down by race and saw this huge disparity where the Black unemployment rate is 16.2%, the white unemployment rate is 8%, and the national rate is just a hair over 9%. So they said, okay, well, how does this play out over history? And this was the thing that shocked me, was we've had this 2x gap between whites and Blacks for more than 60 years, since the post-World War II years. We don't have enough time on the show to say how many things have changed between then and now, yet this rate has held steady, and this is the sort of spark that got me going on this story.
While the unemployment rate that most people talk about is 9.2%, which would be about 16% for Blacks, there's also the underemployment rate, which in general is about 16%. That includes people who have given up looking for work or only working part-time. Now, does the 2-for-1 ratio also apply for the underemployment rate? That would bring it about 30% for underemployment for African Americans.
I wouldn't say you would double it or you would tack on another 14% there. The Labor Department's data does not get into that much detail in terms of underemployment, which is workers who've stopped looking, workers who are part-time but don't want to be part-time, and a few other scenarios there. That 16% rate is actually only for Blacks, that is only for workers who are out of work but who are actively looking. They have applied for a job in the last 4 months, and they are on the hunt, but they don't have anything right now.
Let's look at those factors. Most of us think, well, educational deficit, our educational system is not what it should be. The prevalence of racism, the idea that Blacks were the last hired, first fired, and there have been many, many layoffs in the public sector where many African Americans found work, the decrease in the manufacturing centers and outsourcing. Give us a breakdown of some of those things and why they don't really answer the question.
The issue of economic upheaval in the United States, particularly the prevalence of outsourcing in the last, say, 20 years, 30 years, the decline of American manufacturing, that was my starting point. I've read my William Julius Wilson, the celebrated
right.
sociologist. I know what he has referred to, and general economic upheaval is something that comes up a lot in his work, you know, which results in the hollowing out of inner cities and the loss of strong middle-class jobs. But when you dig deeper into it, it may have a role, this decline of manufacturing, but it is nowhere even close to being the defining reason, because in 1979, employment in manufacturing in the United States was at its peak. Yet that two times gap that we're talking about between blacks and whites and unemployment was still there. So then you have to think, okay, well, maybe this has a role in later years, but it can't have been the main reason because just that it doesn't match up. The next thing I looked at was education. You know, the president himself has said that we will educate our way out of recessions. We will educate our way out of racial inequality, except that the racial gap with education has narrowed. We've seen college graduation rates among black men and black women increase fairly significantly in recent decades. We've seen this as a result, whether of affirmative action policies in the college level or just, you know, growing, I guess some improvements in public education, though I don't want to go too far down that road. So that gap has closed. It's still there. There is still a gap, but it's closing. Yet the unemployment gap, again, held steady. So education, while that may play something of a role, again, it's not that smoking gun that we're looking for. So what it came down to for me was, on the one hand, incarceration. Incarceration is a huge, huge issue. It's been called the new Jim Crow of the 21st century. It especially impacts blacks in America. Blacks are six times as likely to be incarcerated as whites and three times as likely as Hispanics. And a wealth of research and data shows that if you are incarcerated, once you've done your time and you get out, you're significantly hindered in getting jobs. You're wearing a scarlet letter. There's a stigma attached to you for a very long time. Now, the prison part of this is interesting because that 16.2% that we're referring to does not include prison populations. Mm-hmm. It doesn't include institutional populations. And so research shows that if you really, really want to know what the black unemployment rate is, you got to look at, like, you know, maybe 18, 19, 20%. You've got to add several percentage points. I didn't use that because, or at least I didn't use that throughout the piece because, you know, it's hard to compare that over time. There's no firm data like there is government data. So prison is a big one, but the biggest one that I had was flat-out racism, discrimination. There is, you know, we are not by any means in a post-racial society, as some would have us believe. And the issues of discrimination in the workplace, the issues of racism in hiring, are alive and well. Again, as a wealth of academic data, especially in the last few decades, has shown us. And that, to me, and then also racism is something that you can say has been around over this 60-plus year period. So that was kind of one of the big conclusions that I ended at.
Have there been studies that have been done that point in that direction also? I'm thinking especially of one that you cite in your article, of interviews between whites and blacks applying for jobs.
And I think he's getting into a lot of the information you have about DevoPager and the testing systems, the racial testing, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's the study that pops out, which is why I used it. She was a professor at Northwestern at that time, went to Milwaukee in 2001, sent out a pair of black college-age men and a pair of white college-age men, and she gave them identical backgrounds, identical job resumes, identical, they even looked alike, they dressed alike, they were told to, you know, talk alike. The only difference was that one would, you know, within these pairs, one would pose as an ex-con and one wouldn't. So you have this criminal record and obviously race are the differences. And what she found was that if you have a criminal record, the callbacks that you receive from potential employers dropped off pretty significantly. And that was to be, she suspected that. But she found that when she crunched the data and broke it down by race, she found that her white applicants with a criminal record got more callbacks than blacks without a criminal record, which to her was, you know, lit up this huge light bulb that indicated, well, yes, a criminal record is a huge part of this, but man, so is race. You know, and she said she told me she was quite surprised. She did not think race would play such a big role. And these kinds of studies where you rule out everything but race are coming, you know, quick and fast. And they have in recent years. There's another one with identical job applicants, and the only difference is they have it's white, quote-unquote, white-sounding names versus black-sounding names. So you would have Greg and Emily, what are the white-sounding names, and Lakeisha and Jamal are the black-sounding names, and they were identical except for those names for the purposes of applying for jobs. And there was a significant discrepancy, a significant drop-off for Lakeisha and Jamal in the job application process. And these experiments have been replicated a lot, and they expose an uncomfortable truth, which is that this is not, you know, we're not a colorblind society, at least when it comes to jobs, and the issue of racism is still pervasive, and we need policy, we need more work, more effort to tackle this.
So we've been through some of Michelle Alexander, who has talked about and written about the new Jim Crow, and we certainly understand that, the Shelby Steeles and the Dinesh D'Souzas, who would have us live in a post-racialist society. The facts of life do not prove these out. So we're still left with a persistent attitudinal racism and an institutional racism that manifests itself in a lot of the different ways that you've spoken about. So were there periods where there was a growth in African-American employment, and what do you attribute that to?
Tracing this 60-plus year period where the black unemployment rate has held steady at twice as high as the white unemployment rate, there is one notable period where this gap shrunk, where it narrowed. It didn't narrow by all that much, but it did. And it's the one place we can point to. It's the one place some fantastic academics have pointed to. And it's, not surprisingly, the late 1960s and early 1970s, the heart of the civil rights era, the civil rights movement in the United States. And especially, this was a time of a flurry of civil rights legislation. We had the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, the creation of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. And what the research looking at this period suggests is that not only did you have policy specifically created to tackle issues of racism and civil rights, and that policy had something of a direct effect on discrimination in the workplace and elsewhere, but you also, it just, civil rights, the issues of race relations, they were in the news. They were in the public discussion. They were in the forefront of Americans' minds. And they, you know, researchers, and I believe this as well, believe that just the issue being out there and so openly discussed and on the front pages every day just put it in people's minds more, and you saw less discrimination as a result of this. You know, it was an open confrontation of a institutional and deep-seated problem. But when it was out there, it sort of, at least in terms of the workplace, it waned a little bit. Now, by about the mid to late 1970s, this gap opened wide once more to this two-times gap, and then the Reagan era just went off the charts, and it's held steady now again at about two times. But researchers have pointed to this era and try to use it as a roadmap for the present. What can we do now to not copy the late 60s and early 70s, but maybe draw on that period for the present? Because these problems are still persistent now as they were before the civil rights era, civil rights movement. Maybe we can beef up the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Maybe we can pass new legislation that would address the issue of hiring discrimination. And that's where some of the discussion is happening. And it only makes sense because they're looking to the past and trying to find out what worked and applying that to the present. Are the late 60s and 70s perfectly analogous to the present? Absolutely not. But it's the only example we've got.
Well, I must say that along with, of course, the mass movement that ushered in from the African-American community, which helped establish so many other movements that stood on the shoulders of that, and it ushered in all these, the Civil Rights Act of 64 and the Voting Rights Act of 65, et cetera. I guess we definitely need a mass movement again today of African-Americans. But just in the last minute that we have, so should the government hold back, or should lawmakers make even further investments of federal money to deal with this intransigent, horrible problem that exists?
direct federal investment is definitely one solution, and it was one posed by most economists I interviewed for the story. Mostly these economists tend to lean toward the left. I mean, they support federal spending. You just don't get that with more conservative or free market economists. But, you know, when you talk about direct federal spending, you cut discrimination and racism out of the equation. You can target hard-hit inner-city neighborhoods or neighborhoods in southern cities where we're seeing just astronomical unemployment, or a city like Detroit. And you can put people to work directly without having to grapple with the hiring problem. Now, does that fix our this institutional racism we're dealing with? No. But in the middle of a jobs crisis right now, and an incredibly terrible jobs crisis for Black Americans, direct federal intervention, you know, it has been proven to work in the past. It certainly would work now, and you don't have to worry about employers second-guessing their hires if they are Black. And so that's one idea. Unfortunately, the debate here in Washington right now begins and ends with how much spending to cut, but maybe once we get out of this crazy debate we're having now about, you know, cutting and the debt ceiling and all that, we could see some lawmakers, or maybe if they, you know, the Republican majority in the House gets tossed on its butt in 2012, we could see some movement on federal intervention, especially in really hard-hit areas, because frankly, it's hard to see how these areas will rebound without it.
Well, I want to encourage people to go to TomDispatch.com and read What We Don't Talk About When We Talk About Jobs, How Racism, Global Economics, and the New Jim Crow Fuel Black America's Crippling Job Crisis. It is tremendously important food for thought and for action.
Well, thanks so much for having me. Fantastic discussion.
We've been speaking with Andy Kroll, associate editor of Tom Dispatch and reporter at Mother Jones Magazine. Read this article. It's really important.
They used to tell me I was building a dream. So I followed them all. When there was earth to plow, all guns to bear, I was always there, right on the job. They used to tell me I was building a dream with peace and glory ahead. Why should I be standing in this line waiting for bread? Once I built a railroad, I made it run. Made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once I built a tower up to the sun, brick and rivet and lime. Once I built a tower, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime?
Debtor and Dr. John in Yip Hawberg's Depression Classic.
It was Al all the time. Don't you remember? I'm your pal. Say, buddy, can you spare a dime? Buddy, can you spare a dime.
Now the acclaimed public intellectual and author of Democracy Matters and Race Matters, Cornel West, as he spoke recently at a youth teach-in, continues to stir us to organize.
I am here because I believe, like you, that too many of our brothers and sisters of all colors are suffering and their misery is unnecessary, and we plan to do something about it. We approach this day fundamentally committed to what Brother Martin Luther King was committed to, unarmed truth. And we know the condition of truth is to allow suffering to speak. It could be our brothers and sisters on reservations. It can be our red or brown brothers and sisters in barrios. It could be our white brothers and sisters locked into poverty in Kentucky and other places. It can be yellow brothers and sisters. And it can be my black brothers and sisters too often tied to prison industrial complex, dilapidated houses, unavailable child care, still unavailable health care after Obamacare. And we have some young people all around the nation. And yes, even those in privileged institutions of higher learning who have not decided to become well-adjusted to injustice, but still want to think critically in their quest for truth and say they can be agent to highlight the corporate greed that undergirds the military-industrial complex with its imperial presence in Afghanistan and Iraq and dropping those drones in Pakistan. Yes, it also undergirds that prison-industrial complex, 2.5 million locked in, 72% soft drug offenses, and the financial sector shot through with levels of greed that even Charles Dickens would have problems trying to depict. And then the entertainment complex that bombards our young people with weapons of mass distraction. They keep them titillated and stimulated and so thoroughly distracted that they no longer want to fundamentally focus on the most fundamental issues that every education ought to be about, which is what does it really mean to be human and what are you going to do with your life? What level of decency and courage and compassion will be manifest in your short move from your mama's womb to tomb just to make big, 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 big money and find yourself in a condition of spiritual malnutrition and moral constipation where you know what's right. It's just stuck in too much greed and it won't come out. Don't get locked into that truncated apathy, that truncated imagination. Historically, young people have played a disproportionate role in democratic awakenings. And if we don't awake now, we're right with sliding down a slippery slope to not just chaos, but social strife with strong conservative right-wing neo-fascist elements emerging with power, with big, big, big money behind them. And in this age of Obama, let us be very clear that even as we celebrate his symbolic and cosmetic and cathartic victory and presence, we are going to reassure, or we're going to do all that we can, that he doesn't become just another black mascot of Wall Street oligarchs, just another black pawn of corporate plutocrats,
when we hear Mr. Daley or Mr. Geithner and others whispering in his ear, and they got Brother Martin in the Oval Office saying, don't forget about the poor people. Don't forget about sanitation workers. We young folk have an analysis. We young folk have a fresh take on what's going on. We want something beyond symbols. We want substance. We want empowerment of poor people. We want the downsizing of those banks that are too big to fail, but oh, young people with no school loans are too young to rescue, too little to rescue. Is that the level of hypocrisy that we're dealing with? Then tell us the truth. As young brothers and sisters, and you can see I'm old school, but I try to stay connected as I can with the younger generation. So I want to see your courage. Don't show me the big job that you got and your status and your stature. Don't be a peacock, be an eagle. Don't generate foliage. I want to see what your fruit actually is. That's what the younger generation needs to do. And you need to do it with some of us older folk, because we can learn from you and you can learn something from us. And I'm damn near 60 years old. Should have been dead long time ago. But want to be faithful unto death. Young folk, keep track of who's paying the cost. Learn how to straighten your back up. And any time young people, courageous people, progressive people, straighten their backs up, you're going somewhere, because folk can't ride your back unless it's bent. And that's what we learn in Madison. We learn in Indiana. We learn in Ohio. And we learned it in Northern Africa with Tunisia and in Egypt, just like we learned it in the early 90s with Nelson Mandela and others. Do we have what it takes to engage in this fight back against corporate greed? That's the question today, connecting thought and deed. I just want to say, as an old school brother, I am there with you, because I'm going down swinging.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.